Okay, we'll get it going. Yeah. I'm sorry. Actually, it's not one that I own, but it's one that I've seen. And it's a hawk mask. And these masks and so forth, particularly Northwest Coast tradition masks, fell into a couple of categories. I mean, some belong to a family. It was interesting. They often were stories as to how they came by them. Some were ceremonial masks in terms of they told a story that belonged to the whole tribe as to how the sun got in the sky and how we got fire. And some were shamanic. They were very powerful. And in fact, after the shaman died, the people were real interested in getting rid of all that stuff because they were afraid there was so much, you know, chutzpah, so much power inside those that if anybody touched it, they would die. And so some of these things are now being repatriated to the tribes they came from. They were real eager to get rid of in the first place, back in the 1800s and so on, because they're worried. But it's not one that I own, no. We're doing musculoskeletal today, and this is an interesting picture. Anybody recognize this right here? This is the book. This is the textbook. The chapter on musculoskeletal is fairly brief, but it's nice and concise, and I definitely would recommend that you read it. Most of the questions that I'm going to be submitting for Monday's test will be from the lecture material, but not all of them. So there are some things that you do need to take a look at the textbook. All right, what I want to do first off, we're going to talk a little bit about bone formation, and we're going to spend a good bit of the time here in this first hour talking about bones, congenital and inherited, or congenital and acquired bone diseases and so forth, and then we'll be looking at joint diseases in the second hour. And one of the important things that will come up there, we talk about things like rheumatoid arthritis and so forth. These diseases that are connected, that are autoimmune in nature, are typically systemic. And that's one thing that will be real important to be paying attention to when we talk about rheumatoid arthritis, because it involves a lot of systems, including the eye. But we're going to be starting here with skeletal problems, and here we're looking at development of the bones. And this right here would be in utero. Long bone formation is a little bit different than bones of the skull. Long bone formation, in fact, is substantially different. In the case of long bone formation, there is a cartilage model, effectively, that starts out in utero fairly early. You'll see it 8 weeks here of gestation. And eventually begins. It starts to undergo ossification, but leaves behind for a period of years, many years, these so-called growth centers, these epiphyseal growth lines. And that's how we elongate bones, the bones of the extremities. The appendicular skeleton, as it's called. And so this is where this has to stay active. This area of cartilage right here is what really grows. And then as it proliferates, the bone gets longer, and the cartilage undergoes transformation into a mature bone back here. So this is about what it looks like at the time of birth, with a fair bit of cartilage still in these long bones. This is called inchondral bone formation, and this is most of our skeleton, but not all of our skeleton. We'll take a look at a congenital anomaly where the signal to those cartilage cells to stay alive and continue growing dissipates and disappears very quickly, and the person is very short stature, at least of the bones, very short bones, and of the ones that grow and proliferate in this way. There's a bone marrow space in here, obviously, and some stuff goes on in there. I mean, that's where all of our hematopoietic tissue lives. And if we have conditions of the bone, and we'll see there is a congenital condition here in just a little bit, in which the bone doesn't mature as it should, and that space gets smaller and smaller as the bone begins to grow and grow, it squashes that bone marrow cavity. And one of the complications, long-term complications of that, will be bone marrow failure, because there's nowhere for the bone marrow, for the hematopoietic tissue, the things that are making white cells and platelets and red cells, to go. So the bone itself, long bones in particular, are quite complex. They are constantly being remodeled and renewed by standing and walking, and our posture and so forth determines what's going on, but it's constantly being remade. But it's not only structure and being able to stand up and locomote and so forth, that within the bone then is the is where our bone marrow is, and that plays an important role. And if something changes in that, in terms of the hospitality, shall we say, of the bone marrow elements, the hematopoietic tissue to survive, it's not going to. This is the other way in which bones are formed in utero. And when it's done, everything looks exactly the same. It's just that it comes into being in a different way. In this case, this is called membranous bone formation, and there are several places where that occurs. And in the case of the skull, it occurs here, the calvarium. The blue cartilage here, or what shows as purple rather, is cartilaginous, and so the base of the skull does have a cartilage model that it works from, but not the rest of the skull. And these bones float, and I'm sure you're very much aware of the fact that babies have what are called soft spots, fontanelles, where these bones that are sort of out here like tectonic plates in a way, are allowed to move, and they have to be able to move at the time of birth. I mean, the skull is substantially compressed at the time of birth in order to get that kid out of there, and then it sort of springs back. Eventually, of course, these bones are going to grow and meet and fuse, and the skull does become solid. But that happens relatively late, and archaeologically, we use that sometimes to determine the age of skeletal remains. Are those sutures where the spaces between these, say right in here, are those closed and what do they look like? So that sometimes helps us determine the age of skeletal remains of archaeologic specimens, or if we find somebody out in the woods and all that's left of them are bones, and it turns out it was a hunter or a forensic site or something, often that's what will be used to determine skeletal age. Joint formation is also relatively complex. We have a number of different kinds of joints, and we'll elaborate, talk on that in a little more detail. Not all of our joints, we think about the joints as being highly mobile, but not all of our joints are, and we don't want some joints to move at all. The joint is just simply a connection between two bones or a bone and something else. And for example, there is what's called a fibrous joint that holds my teeth into my jaw. My teeth don't grow directly and are not completely grown straight into my jaws. You know, you can pull the suckers out. Well, there's a fibrous joint there. It's a point of communication. I don't want it moving. I don't want my teeth coming out. Probably know if you had a problem with, say, vitamin C in your diet and so forth, you could be losing teeth because you're not making the collagen that's normally being rebuilt all the time, and your teeth will fall out. So there are joints that are not very flexible and some that are designed not to be flexible at all. Now these, on the other hand, this would be an articular joint, such as I'd have in my fingers or other places in my appendicular skeleton, and they are meant to be movable. And they are extremely friction-free in here. This is the most amazing sort of surface in here, particularly with the addition of the synovial fluid. But the joint forms like this with cartilage that remains over the surface, both bones, their articular surfaces, and it is quite slippery. In fact, it's almost friction-free. Some of the joints have to be stabilized. The knee joint, the most probably the best example of that in terms of having a joint in here that is just not terribly stable. We are relatively new to walking upright. Granted, it's probably been 3 or 4 million years since we started doing that, but we had to make some modifications in that joint to try and stabilize the knee joint. And I mean, anybody who watches football, which I happen to waste a lot of time watching football, and I would just like to point out that I am not the absolute bottom in my fantasy league. I have won one game, so I'm actually off the dead zero list. But in order to, the knee joint is quite unstable. I mean, you don't have to hit on the knee to tear up the cartilages and so forth that come in from the side, the so-called meniscus cartilages, lateral and medial meniscus cartilages, that are in there to stabilize that joint. It is just not one that was really sort of designed initially for upright posture. And so there are some stabilizing things that occasionally occur in joints, and sometimes even something like this that we have here at the collarbone, where my quarterback went down and broke his a couple of weeks ago. At any rate, that would be a kind of joint that has this kind of stabilizing and cushioning thing in the middle of it. Most of our joints, however, articular joints, look like this, where there's cartilage that sort of smoothly rubs against one another, one surface against the other, and is even fluid, like and it feels very much like motor oil. If you ever had an occasion to see someone have a joint tap, take a look at the fluid that comes out or even feel it, it's amazingly slippery. It is designed and looks just like kind of like Mobile One. All right, well, that's what we're going to be looking at in the second half of this episode today. Let's go back to the bone itself now. And bone is constantly being renewed and rebuilt, and sometimes, of course, it has to be healed if we have a fracture or something. And if we take a look at what goes on in terms of that bone, it's a pretty much what occurs early on in life when we were looking at the initial ossification of those cartilage models of the long bones. And I use the term ossification because this is not calcification. Yes, there's a lot of calcium in bone. In fact, that's where virtually all of our calcium is. But this process is ossification, which means bone formation. Bone is very complex material. There's matrix behind it, a connective tissue matrix, that the calcium becomes basically non-enzymatically associated with to make the bones rigid. So this process is not just calcification, it is ossification. Ossifying meaning bone formation. Over here, we're taking a look at immature bone that is just sort of thrown together. This is often referred to as woven bone. And what you will see over here on the other side is something that looks kind of like plywood in terms of the layers of the bone. And this is a much stronger bone. Initially, if we take a look at a healing fracture, or we would take a look at the first events of ossification in utero of bones, we would see that the bones are formed of this woven bone, which is not terribly strong. And it's not really organized yet in terms of upright posture. So at least for the long bone, the leg bones anyway. But this becomes remodeled over time into this lamellar bone based on the stress lines, the stress forces that are on the bones themselves. And so lamellar bone refers to the laminations that we see here. The holes in here are the osteocytes. And those are cells that are busy producing that matrix that gets oozed out into the environment of the bone itself, and then that spontaneously complexes with the calcium to produce the rigid bone. And so, once that's done, you might think that's the end of the story, but it's not. It gets remodeled every day. And if a person spends some time down on their back, if they're in traction or they're not able to get around, or they're paraplegic, God forbid, something should happen to an accident, and they cannot stand upright again, we're going to see phenomenal reorganization of the long bones, the bones of the legs, and a tremendous amount of loss of bone mass and calcium that will occur there simply because there's not the stress on those bones to keep them mineralized and at the level that they should be. The ultimate construction of a long bone is this, and this we're taking a look here at a slice out of it, kind of like a little piece of the pie. And you'll see that the lamellae are assembled in little Haversian canals. And that's the outer cortex of the bone, and it's extremely hard. You've all seen it in the meat counter, you know, the white ring around it and the marrow cavity in the middle. So that would be kind of the construction of a long bone. Here we're taking a look at essentially a bone, I suppose, of a healthy nature. My guess is they induced some active bone growth in an experimental animal and then killed it and made this section. But anyway, what we see here, this is a bone spicule that's growing in, and it's woven bone right now. And here we're looking at tunic that contain osteoclasts. Osteoclasts are the bone destroying cells. They actually come from the bloodstream. They are macrophages. They're derived from macrophages. And they actually have capacity to produce acid just the way you do it in the stomach. It's exactly the same enzyme system that produces acid. And what they do is they sort of suck themselves down over the bone, they create a seal, and then they secrete the acid and dissolve the bone. Why do they want to do that? Well, the idea here is that you're going to realign the bone based on the stress lines on it. All these cells out here are osteoblasts. They're busy making bone matrix, which is what is this thing right here. And so there's a constant remodeling going on. If we were to take a bone section from anybody in this room, we would see some degree of remodeling going on. This depicts that, and I sort of stole this picture right out of your textbook. But this shows the osteoclast, which is typically a multinucleated cell. And it sort of sucks itself down here and begins to secrete an acid that dissolves and removes the bone. And then the osteoblasts are rebuilding it again based on what are the stress lines on that bone. Eventually, the osteoblasts are trapped. They basically secrete the osteoid around them, and in time they become trapped in the thing, and then we call them osteocytes. They kind of slow down their activity, but they are there and do maintain some degree of bone health of what's already there. That bright pink stripe is the non-calcified or non-ossified bone matrix. And that bone matrix is very rich in collagen, collagen type 1, and we're going to take a look here in just a minute of a disease in which we have a defect in the capacity to produce collagen type 1 and what happens. Osteogenesis imperfecta. This is a congenital problem, and we see it as bones, and it gets its name, as you will see, imperfect production of the bones. Osteogenesis, the manufacture of these bones. In fact, it's a problem of collagen production. And there are many variants of it, and if you can't produce the collagen, and everything you can think of that could go wrong in terms of the genes that code for collagen, if you can imagine there's a stop code in the middle, if there's a mutation that leads to a shortened messenger RNA lifespan, if there's an operator gene, I don't know if we use those terms anymore, but if there's an operator gene abnormality that basically turns it on, everything you can think of that could go wrong with a gene can go wrong and has been described. And that's why when we see this, we'll see that there are many different variants of it, which are the genetic variants. The ultimate thing is you can't produce collagen, and typically collagen type 1. And so the bones are quite brittle. Some of these are inherited as autosomal recessive, some it's dominant, and so forth. And there are just, again, many different kinds of mutations that might happen in that gene complex. And so ultimately what you can't do is produce the collagen. If you can't produce the collagen, there are going to be a lot of connective tissue problems because type 1 collagen is used in a lot of places. There are four basic species of collagen that we have. Some are springier than others, but four basic species that are in different parts of our body, connective tissue parts of our body. This happens to be one that was a lethal. This is it was a stillborn infant, and what it's pointing out are all the fractures that occurred in utero. I don't know, my guess is we probably have a few mothers in here, or you've heard of your sister or somebody telling you stories of babies jumping around, and maybe you've even felt it yourself. You know that they certainly kick around a lot. Some really rich chocolate pudding and be pregnant, and you'll know what it's like when that kid starts kicking around in there. Get yourself a couple cappuccinos and just see how active that child becomes. And it will do that. Well, in this case, it just moving around in the uterus, in that amniotic fluid, was sufficient to break the bones. And so we have a lot of healed fractures. This was a stillborn. There's a variant, some of these are simply not compatible with life. Others are, the kid is born, and you can count on they're going to break bones at the time of delivery. If you've ever broken a bone, you know it hurts. All right? It hurts a lot. And it doesn't matter whether you're going to break a bone every time you step off of the twist your ankle, instead of spraining your ankle, you break it in two places. All these kids hurt like hell when they break a bone, and they're all very short stature. Eventually, they never grow very tall, and one of the reasons for that is that if they fracture through that epiphyseal growth line, it will close off prematurely. It'll close off when they're 8, 7, 8, 9, instead of going on into their teenage years. So they're short stature, they can't do what their friends would do, and they're pissed off, and I would be too. And if you have that in somebody who's got a Y chromosome on top of it, I can guarantee you that's a really nasty combination. A genetic defect like this, and you say, look, you can't do the skateboard thing, you can't really do the bicycle thing, you can't do sports, be very careful when you go out, and you've had 5 fractures or 10 fractures by the time you're 9 or 10, and they all hurt, you're pretty pissed off with your situation in life. So many times these kids are as much of psychiatric you're dealing with when you're dealing with that person, and you will see them, I guarantee it, because it's not that an uncommon event. But it's as much a psychiatric issue to deal with and behavioral thing as it is the metabolic. Some kinds of these will have what are called blue sclera. Here's an example of osteogenesis imperfecta, and what we're looking at here is instead of that very dense connective tissue, collagen type 1 that makes up the sclera, it is weak. Could you rupture the eyeball? I probably could. I don't know. Do you have retinal separations? I don't know. Ask Dr. Bagley about it. But anyway, they may have blue sclera. Well, the sclera is not blue. The sclera is translucent. And what you're doing is you're looking into the vitreous back here, and you're seeing the pigment layer that's behind that retina. and that's what you're looking at here. And it appears to be blue sclera. That's an example of that. The Dune Folk thing, if you've ever read the Frank Herbert books, Dune, or seen that really awful movie they made out of it, you'll know what I'm talking about there. So that's a problem of connective tissue. But it manifests itself as very brittle bones. And so they fracture a lot, and because of that, they end up with short stature, among other things. But that never changes. I mean, that's going to be their life. Their life is much shorter. There are, again, variants of this. It depends on where the mutation occurs, how much collagen can you make, how close to what you want, the desirable collagen do you have. There appears to be what will be called penetrance, variable penetrance. Some people are extremely fragile. Others are not so. All right, we're going to move on to something else. This is an interesting thing. It goes by a name which is completely wrong, osteopetrosis. What does the petros mean in there? Petros, Peter, the rock, right? Rock of the church, Peter. Petros. Yes? Rock? This says rocky bones, rock bones, osteopetrosis. And beyond having absolutely nothing like that, it's sometimes called marble bones disease. Imply that it's extremely strong, and nothing could be further from the truth. These bones are extremely weak. They're very chalk-like. It ought to be called osteo-chalk-like bones, you know what I mean? What happens here is an interesting thing. Once again, there are dozens and dozens of mutations that are involved with the formation and maturation of osteoclasts. And I mentioned that the bones have to be remodeled. And so these bones are remodeled starting from the very get-go. You've got a cartilage model. It starts to ossify. The first bone formation is woven bone. It has to be switched over and remodeled to lamellar bone. And this guy, you have to be able to remove the old bone. It's just that simple. And if you can't do it, you're sort of keep layering more and more. The osteoblasts, the ones that are making this bone matrix, they don't know that the osteoclast is defective. Now, the osteoclasts, again, are derivatives of macrophages that are in the circulating blood, monocytes. They're in the circulating blood. They basically migrate into this. Well, I'm not sure how they all do, but they are derivatives of that. And so there are mutations that occur such that they don't know what they're supposed to do. They cannot produce, sometimes there are mutations that lack the ability to produce the acid, so you can't dissolve and remove the old bone. And what happens is the bone gets thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker, and it's all woven bone. It's none of this lamellar bone. And in fact, those bones are very brittle and rigid, and it's just like a piece of chalk. And you can snap them in a heartbeat, even though they're thick as they can be. The other thing that happens with this is that as you begin to build up and build up and build up the bone, and of course the osteoblasts don't realize that the osteoclasts are not removing the old stuff, eventually the bone marrow cavity disappears. As you layer and layer and layer and layer more of this woven bone on top of itself, eventually the bone marrow cavity disappears, and they become literally a solid piece of chalk. And then people have, as you can imagine, lots of problems in terms of, you know, where are you going to make now the erythroid elements, the red cells, the white cells, and all that, because they got no home. They don't know where to go to. They got a couple places they can go to, but you can't really make enough red cells, enough in the way white cells, platelets, and things like that to keep a person going if you don't have a substantial amount of marrow space, and these people lose it all. Okay, lots of fractures, very rigid bones. Here is something, achondroplasia. This is, I was alluding to the fact that, now what this would imply, you say achondroplasia, it's saying no cartilage tissue. That's the plasia is the tissue, A is without, so I don't have any cartilage tissue. Well, that's not right at all. We took a look at the bone growth of the long bones, the elongation of the bones, and that occurs at the epiphyses, the so-called epiphyseal ends. And if you have the cartilage has to stay alive. And what the cartilage is trying to do is all the time it's there, it's trying to kill itself. It's trying to undergo apoptosis or stop replicating. And what we do is, and there's a surface protein for those cartilage cells at the epiphyseal growth line that basically says, go ahead and kill yourself. Forget it. Job's done. We don't need you anymore. But it's not active because we make a decoy protein that sits down on that receptor and tells it and neuters it. So it really does not affect it all the way through to start that so-called the process of apoptosis. These people lack that, in some situations, lack that decoy protein so that the cartilage cell, which is trying to kill itself all the time, is not told, don't do it. Again, there are a number of mutations that we know occur with this. Most of the times, this is inherited as autosomal dominant, and most are spontaneous mutations. See, if it's autosomal dominant, and you end up as a dwarf, such as this right here, achondroplastic dwarf, it would have to be in your family. It'd have to be transmitted, but most people don't. You say, well, nothing like that was in my family. Dad's not, my mother's not one of these. How did it happen to me? Well, it's a spontaneous mutation. So most of these are, in fact, spontaneous mutations, and you end up with fusion, premature closure, and fusion of the epiphyseal growth line, because often that decoy protein that sells to the cartilage cell, don't kill yourself. I know that's what you want to do, but don't do it. The end result is epiphyseal lines close off early. And what we'll find is that the bones that don't particularly grow that way, such as the bones of the spine and the ribs and the skull and so forth, they go on growing as they're supposed to. And so when you see somebody who's an achondroplastic dwarf, the bone, their sitting height is correct. In other words, if I were to measure from their butt to their head, it's what it ought to be. The trunk, the chest, and everything else is basically what it ought to be. It's just their limbs are very short. People like this particularly Native American cultures were extremely revered. They thought that they were essentially sort of been touched by the gods. They were considered to be very important in society. They were looked after. They often became shamans and so forth, both males and females. There is a version of this which is extremely severe. If by whatever chance you should have two of these mutations, that's incompatible with life. But there is one which is very, very severe, and it leads to basically no bone formation of the chest, or the chest is quite small. I don't know if you've heard about it. Your book refers to it as thantophoric dwarfism, and what the thanto means death, phoric means loving, death loving, and this is a death loving mutation. And these kids basically have an extremely small chest and basically no lung development because there's no space for it in utero. Well, those never live, those are all uniformly die, but I'm sure everybody in here has seen a achondroplastic dwarf. Now, other things that could lead to dwarfism, we'll talk about during the endocrine unit. If you don't have enough growth hormone, you'll stop growing. And that's a different thing. And those people look perfectly normal. It's just that everything is very small. This right here is premature closure of the epiphyseal growth lines. Now, bones are highly vascular. And of course, there's bone marrow space in the middle of it. I mean, there's a lot of blood flowing through the bones at any time. And if you have bacteria in your bloodstream, it's possible that you can get an infection in the bone. Now, if you have a penetrating wound that puts part of your, you know, the dashboard of your car into your bone, or you shoot yourself, which is a real popular thing right about now, the way it works is this. It's coming up to deer season here in southern Indiana, and in fact, it's going on right now, but people who are out hunting deer will either bow or with a gun. One of the favorite things to do is to go out and you have a shotgun with a shotgun slug in it, you know, as opposed to a little bitty shot. And it's cold and you're standing out there waiting for the deer to come by. And frankly, I'm very much in favor of this because the only natural predator of the deer, you see him running around here, all right? The only natural predator is the automobile. We have no natural predators anymore for white-tailed deer. But at any rate, You know, people are out there and it's cold and they're standing by the tree and they've got the shotgun down. This is very common. I'm serious. I worked for 2 years in an emergency room. I can't tell you how many of these I saw. And the muzzle is down on their boot and it's cold, so you're sort of flipping your foot like this. You know, you're trying to stay warm and the safety is off. And you shoot right through the shoe, right through. And so you carry all the, you know, since you came through the cow pasture to get there and step in the road apples from the horses and things like that, you just carried all that fecal matter, everything right on through, just blew that straight into your, right into your foot and into the bones. But at any rate, penetrating wounds, whether it's automobile accident or fractures where the bone comes out through the skin and you end up with dirt and crud in it, that's an obvious thing. That's how you can get some bacterial infections of the bone. But most infections of the bone don't occur with that at all. Most infections of the bone occur simply because you got bacteria in the bloodstream and the bone is so highly vascularized that the bacteria somehow found a home there temporarily or began to grow there. And that's what we're looking at here, is a is an infection of the bone, effectively an abscess, you might say, right here. The term is osteomyelitis because it's involving not only the bone itself but also the marrow cavity. That's the myel part of it, and the itis, of course, is inflammation, osteomyelitis. A vast majority of these are Staphylococcus, because that's a bug that's around us all the time. It's in our mouths, it's on our skin, it's every place. Now you might think, I don't have bacteria in my bloodstream. I am clean. Do you ever have bacteria in your bloodstream? Do you think you ever have bacteria in your bloodstream? Yeah, of course you do. If you brush your teeth this morning, you have bacteria in your bloodstream. They shower in there. If you brush your teeth and you culture your blood, you'd be shocked to see the number of bacteria that you have there. You still want to brush your teeth. Okay. In fact, I have a dental appointment this afternoon to have my teeth cleaned, and I always wait. I tell the gal there that I let my teeth develop their own protective crust. Well, all right. You don't want to let your develop their own protective crust. You want to brush your teeth, but you do shower bacteria in the bloodstream every time. It's amazing to me we don't see more infections than we do. So the most common infection is the most common bug that we live around. One of the screwy exceptions to that, even though this is still very common among people with sickle cell disease, is that people who have sickle cell, they're homozygous for it, do get salmonella infections in the bone. And that one I cannot explain at all. It's still not the most common infection. If we saw somebody who was homozygous for sickle cell, still the most common bug is the one that everybody else gets, but they're the only ones that ever get salmonella, so that one I don't understand. Tuberculosis, if it gets a chance to go to the bone, it loves it. So there are infections that occur in the bone that get there by way of the bloodstream. So we can see, obviously, infections from penetrating wounds, which we kind of expect there. If we jam a piece of something, you know, through the skin and muscle and jam it right into the bone. Syphilis does involve the bone, but kind of indirectly, the syphilitic organism actually infects the covering over the bone, the so-called periosteum. And we'll see very peculiar bone growth and kind of reactively to the inflamed periosteum. But the other ones are actual direct infections of the bone, just like you'd have an abscess in the skin. If you had a big zit on the end of your nose, you know, you sort of were screwing up your courage, I'd say, at this point to ask somebody out, but I'm assuming at this stage of your life you really don't care about that, you know. Besides, do you have a life outside of this building? You know. But let's suppose, hypothetically, that you did, and you were going to ask somebody out to the barn dance, and you got this huge zit on the end of your nose, right, big honker out here, you know. Most likely it's Staphylococcus. Well, that's the most common bug, and that's the most common bug that's going to infect soft tissue and bone and other sorts of things as well. Now, not all episodes of necrosis or death of the bone, and what we were looking at before was basically an abscess, a hole in the bone where the infection had occurred, not all of that is due to an infectious agent. Here we see something on the, this is the a ball of the hip. This is the up here. I'm taking a look at the hip bone, the femur, and looking at the head of the femur. And here you can see something peculiar has happened. If we look over here, we see the cartilage surface. It's been cut so we can see the bone interior here. And here we have this bright white cartilage surface, and it's continuous and it sits on the bone surface right on the edge like it should. And then you come around to this point right here, and my gosh, there's a gap, and it looks like this part is different colored. It's kind of collapsed. This is avascular necrosis. Now, avascular necrosis says there's no blood vessels there. Once again, that's kind of a misnomer. Of course, there are blood vessels there. I will grant that sometimes in development, we'll see young guys, this is more often in guys, than we will see that maybe there weren't quite as many blood vessels there as there should have been. But many times this is related to trauma, jumping and carrying on. Again, we all see it on the top, you know, the actual weight-bearing part of the hip bone. And we can see it in a variety of other things as complications of medical conditions in which the bone is either weak or the blood vessels get clogged up. Well, for example, sickle cell disease. This is a real problem for people who are homozygous sickle cell because the little vessels get clogged. It's also a problem, believe it or not, with the bends, you know, where you have bubbles in the blood come up from the depths too quickly. For reasons I'm not quite clear on, we see it rather commonly in people who have been on fairly large steroid doses. And by steroid, I don't mean growth steroids. I'm talking about glucocorticoids to sort of tamp down the, say, an inflammatory reaction for some other reason. But most of the stuff that occurs sporadically tends to occur in young people. And you can imagine that if you're leaping and jumping and you're 9 years old and you're going to get up on the garage roof and you're going to surprise your sister when she comes out of the door and you've got your cape on, you know, your Superman thing, and you're going to leap off there, you can pretty well cram that thing, jam that femoral head right up into the socket, the acetabulum, and it might take several months or even a couple of years before it finally dies to the point that it sort of collapses as we see here. And there really isn't anything to do to fix that. You have to replace that, and people just sort of put up with the pain and discomfort as long as they can, and then eventually we'll replace that hip joint. And those don't last ad infinitum. One of the guys that I was in medical school with had that, and he's on his third or fourth hip now. They may last for 10 years or 15 years based on what the artificial hip is. But fundamentally, that's what you have to do. Avascular necrosis. There are really a lot of reasons for it to happen, and even some, it appears it is developmental in terms of, did we actually have enough blood vessels form right there beneath that little spot? But otherwise, most times, it's either traumatic or something like that. Here's a condition which is very common. You definitely want to know about osteoporosis. Now, one of the great misnomers of osteoporosis is it's a problem of calcium in the bone, and that's not true at all. It's a problem of bone in the bone. You see, this right here should go by another name. We should call this osteopenia. The term penia refers to shrinkage or a small number. If we were to talk about low platelet count in the bloodstream, we'd say thrombocytopenia. If we say don't have enough red cells, we'd say anemia or something like that. At any rate, what we take a look at here with osteoporosis is decreased bone mass. The actual metabolic characteristics, the metabolic structure of the bone is perfectly normal, just that there ain't very much of it there. Here we're taking a look at two vertebral bodies. These are big vertebral bodies from probably from the lumbar region, where a lot of the weight is being carried when we're standing upright. And this would be a vertebral body that's healthy. This is a vertebral body, same position, same level, totally collapsed. What is going on with osteoporosis? There are a variety of things. Is calcium important? Yes, it is. Now, I realize it sounds like I'm saying one thing and then I'm trying to change it. This bone here is exactly the same in its composition as this bone. It's just that there is not very much of it. Now, what happened so that you didn't have that much? Well, obviously, calcium availability is very important during the time that you're forming and growing bones. And if there's a problem with calcium metabolism and availability during teenage years and on up to about the age of 35 or so, you're not going to have the amount of bone there because you simply didn't have the building blocks to make it out of. Now, everybody starts losing bone mass after about 35 years of age. We lose about 0.7% per year. Women after menopause lose quite a bit more. Estrogen is fairly important in terms of maintenance of and keeping maintenance of the bone health and keeping the bone, keeping new bone being formed. So peak bone, what we call peak bone mass, is very important. And that is when women, all people are growing up and developing, having adequate nutrition, including calcium, is very important. So you can have the bone matrix and you got the calcium to ossify it and everything else. What are some of the problems with osteoporosis? And it doesn't just involve, it also involves men. I say women here are more frequently involved, but men can certainly have very bad osteoporosis as well. There isn't really a specific genetic component to this, but I'll tell you one thing that we have learned, and that is that the vitamin D receptor in the gut, which is needed not to bring in vitamin D, but the vitamin D receptor in the GI tract is what instructs the cell of the GI tract, the epithelial cell, to absorb the calcium. And that vitamin D receptor there is one of the most pleomorphic that there is, one of the most polymorphic that there is in our kind. Some of us have a very good vitamin D receptor that suck up all that, and some have a very weak one. And there's quite a range. It's almost like a range in size of people. You know, you see, talk about a belt-shaped curve. Some of us are tall, some are in the middle, some are short. And it's the same thing with this. Some people have a very active vitamin D receptor, some don't. But that's one of the most important considerations in terms of what appears to be a familial tendency. But can we point to a specific gene that says, bango, here it is, the way we did with, you could with, say, osteogenesis imperfecta, or osteopetrosis, or one of those? No. It's variability. HRT here, by the way, refers to hormone replacement. We talked about, I'm sure you're aware that there is a quite a bit of a controversy. Do we put women postmenopausally on estrogens? And the answer is no, we definitely should not. But what about the woman who has very severe osteoporosis? And that is going to mean lots of fractures. Probably is a smart thing to do then. Do you increase the risk of breast cancer, uterine cancer? Yes, you do. But I can tell you a fracture also increases the likelihood of death from infections and things like that. So it's a matter of what's the smart thing to do. But do we put it in a water supply effectively? No, we don't. Okay. Let's take a look at what the bone looks like microscopically of somebody with osteoporosis. Over here is that healthy bone we were looking at. Over here is the osteoporotic bone. And again, if we pull out that bone and we take a look at it chemically, it's exactly the same as the bone on the other side. So it's not a matter of, is it crappy bone? From a molecular standpoint, the bone is perfectly healthy. It's a problem of bone mass. We don't have sufficient amount. What takes place here is that there is normally a very fine-tuned balance between osteoclastic activity and osteoblastic activity. They are tuned 1-to-1. If the osteoclast removes the bone, the osteoblast puts it back. It's a normal remodeling kind of process. What apparently occurs here is that there is a fraction, the tiniest fraction of a percent, almost infinitesimally small fraction of a percent of increased activity of the osteoclast over the osteoblast. This process takes years and years to develop. So if the osteoclast goes at this ever so slightly faster, then the osteoblast can rebuild the bone. What you're going to end up with are thin bones like this. And again, the disparity is exceedingly small. So the only the treatments that we have for this are that we be sure women are on, men are on, whoever have it, are on sufficient calcium, they have a good diet, but we have to actually slow down the effect of those osteoclasts. And that's one thing that we do. We give agents that will slow down the osteoclast activity. But again, this is something that takes a long time to develop. When I was in practice at Bloomington Hospital as a pathologist for about 20 years. And one of my partners was in Europe. In fact, he and his wife were in Prague, Czechoslovakia. And she was this little whiff and poof of a, you know, gal who had very thin bones. She was just a very, very small person. and they were running to catch a train, and she sort of hollered, grabbed her hip, and fell over. And she broke her hip while she was walking, while she was running. And she had bad osteoporosis, didn't know, and that's when she learned it. A lot of times we see elderly people who say, I fell and I broke my hip. They got it backwards. I broke my hip and then I fell. You see a lot of older people have this, and they have the weak bones. And when they break the hip, then they keel over. And so that's what happened to her. She was in her 50s and broke her hip just running to catch a train. And people have all kinds of long fractures of the arm, fractures of the fingers, and so forth with this. It's a real thing. Well, as I said, it's not exclusively females. Here's an example of a male, and they will develop as the bones collapse and the vertebral bodies collapse. People get shorter, and it's very important. He has what's called a kyphosis here, which refers to the swan's neck, the bending of it to look a bit like a swan. And what happens here is something that I'm sure you've probably seen, and you will see elderly people who come in your practice or in the clinic. You're going to see people come in kind of stooped over, or maybe their head's really down like this. And what happens in that situation is the weight of this head is pretty significant. And if you take a look at the way the spine curves, there are two curves in the spine, such that the head should sit straight over if you were to draw a line through the cervical curve and then a lumbar curve down here. You'll see that the head sits directly on top of that. And if you have, for every degree that you're off dead center, it increases sevenfold the amount of pressure on the anterior surfaces, on the front surface of those vertebral bodies. And so it causes it to compress. And if you've got weak bones, you're going to resorb that bone and you're going to end up coming forward. Well, once you've done that, you're going to come forward more and more over a period of months or years. And so by not having the head straight up and down like that, you begin to wear on the anterior surfaces of these cervical vertebrae and the thoracic vertebrae. And so you develop this very profound bent over thing. And people sometimes can't even take a deep breath because their chest is so compressed because of the way they're bent over. So these are some of the things that we're looking at here. Collapsed vertebrae, the kyphosis, loss in height, hip fractures. And the genetics, as I mentioned, is not very clear, but it really hinges on the variability of that vitamin D receptor. And that brings us around to this, which we're going to pick up when we come back after the break. We'll be talking about vitamin D itself and the two manifestations we see when we see deficiency of vitamin D in terms of bone health. All right, I will see you on the hour, please. And your response is, yes, absolutely, sir. Okay, thank you.